if ever there was a week that showed the health services in a very bad light, it could be said that it was this week. Tens of thousands of nurses and midwives continued their strike actions. Psychiatric nurses refused to work overtime. The GPs came out to protest about cuts and resources, not to mention the furore, the fury even, at the cost overruns at the children's hospital. And in the meantime, sometimes these get forgotten, thousands of patients, some very seriously ill, had their procedures cancelled or delayed. Well, my first guest this morning is Tony O'Brien, who was in charge of the HSE for the past six years. You resigned last May at the height of the cervical check controversy. This week, similar calls for Health Minister Simon Harris to step down. What do you think he should do?
Well, I think that collectively we need to learn the lesson of the furore that surrounded the departure of Noreen O'Sullivan, of Francis Fitzgerald, myself and others, which shows that there's often more heat than light in the cauldron of places like the PAC. We've seen in both of those cases, with the Charlton Tribunal, with the Scully report, that with an objective, proper examination of the facts and a decent amount of time given to do so, that things look different afterwards. So I would suggest that, given that there is a process underway, that
it's just the PwC.
The PwC process, obviously people can judge that when the report comes out. But I don't think we're really adding anything with all this bluster. And there is so much showboating going on at the moment that I don't think it's doing anything.
What do you mean showboating?
Well, for example, this carry-on between Sinn Féin, who are basically trying to leverage the difficulties that Minister Harris is in now to embarrass Fianna Fáil. That's all it is.
Well, clearly they would argue that.
Well, it is clearly what's happening. And I don't think it's adding anything to our understanding of what's going to happen in relation to the Children's Hospital, and neither is it particularly helpful when you'd want your health minister to be more focused on the resolution of the nurses' dispute that you just spoke of than being drawn into this, when in a few weeks' time there will be an objective report. And I would argue, and argue very strongly, that it's better to have that report and then have the discussion rather than have this unseemly rush for headlines and airtime and people basically exploiting the issue for their own political ends, which isn't what the country needs.
Right. Well, if you take quotations from yourself talking about Sinn Féin doing a swap of the balaclava for parliamentary privilege, and you talked about Mark McSharry as the angriest man in Ireland, and you talk about the cauldron that is the PAC, it doesn't seem like making friends and influencing people in those quarters is what's on your mind, or coaxing them along?
Well, I've no need to make friends in those quarters. I spent a good chunk of my career going in and out, being as respectful as I possibly could to the parliamentary process. But I didn't find myself getting an awful lot of respect back. And over the years, sad to say, I have seen a marked deterioration in the quality of behaviour by a number of politicians, which doesn't do this country well. These are people in elected positions who should be setting examples. And I've made the point before that when I appear in public, I like to be judged by what my family and in particular my children would think of my behaviour. And they'd be well advised to do the same. They're setting a really bad example.
Like, they have to ask questions. Yeah. We have to get information. Mm-hmm. Like, civil servants are notoriously cautious about releasing information. And I presume your good self, you don't want everything out there. So if the citizen wants to know, that's why we have these committees.
Yeah. They call you a witness when you go in there. And they ask you questions. They generally don't listen to your answers. They caution you when you go in about saying crazy things about people. They then go on to say crazy things about people. They often drift away from the committee before you've answered, sometimes to go out and give a radio interview in which they'll call for the resignation of the witness before they've heard the answer. Others will come in not having listened to the earlier part of the proceedings and ask the same questions. The PAC in particular has wandered completely off the reservation. It's supposed to be interrogating reports of the Controller and Auditor General. What it does is it just passes, it chases rather, every passing controversy. It tries to elbow out of the way the other committees, often the Health Committee, which is probably the correct committee to be examining current issues. And they simply pay no respect to individuals. And I don't think over time that this PAC has added an awful lot of value, unlike some of the public accounts committees of the past, which have done the state considerable service.
Well, they had a great reputation. But it is notoriously difficult sometimes to get... This is why we have freedom of information, because people don't want to give you information. So the PAC is designed to get that information for the rest of us.
Dr. Gabriel Scally, speaking at a conference in Dublin last week, said he had seen nothing like the Dáil Public Accounts Committee, that it was a culture of bullying. Now, that's a man who carried out an objective review of the facts in an appropriate way, came out with a very hard-hitting report, it has to be said, and was actually being hampered by the PAC, which was dragging the people who tried to carry on the work that I stood away from every day for 5 weeks or so, tying them up in knots, when they should have been A, assisting him, and B, addressing the real issues around cervical check at that time. I would simply argue that their unseemly rush added no value, that it demeans public life in Ireland, and actually they're creating a culture in which the easiest way to survive as a public servant is never actually to do anything. It's the opposite of the culture that the thriving champions of the private sector globally are pursuing. They're rewarding people for taking measured and controlled risk. Whatever you do in the PAC, as far as the PAC is concerned these days, it's wrong. And we can talk about examples with regard to the Children's Hospital, imagine different scenarios and how they'd respond. We might do that yet.
Yes.
But the basic problem is they are corroding public life in Ireland with their antics, their behaviour. They're creating a system in which people do not want to come into the public service anymore. And if you said black, they would say white. If you said red, they would say green.
I can see that you didn't like the experience, but they have a role and function. But seriously, you obviously are very, very angry with them.
I'm not personally angry, but I do...
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I am... In a reasoned way, I think, explaining why I believe the culture that they have developed, which Dr. Scally described as a bullying culture, is doing real harm to public service in Ireland. I'm not in public service anymore. I'm not beholden to them.
Right.
I am, however, very concerned that if this carries on, it will do serious damage to public service in Ireland.
You called Simon Harris a frightened little boy. You said he was weak. Again, this is strong language, isn't it?
I described certain of the things he'd done in a critical way, that's sure. And I didn't say anything publicly that he wouldn't have been aware was my thoughts. But that's done. He himself has said on a number of occasions that looking back, he believes he made mistakes and that he's learned from them. Nobody's perfect. All we can really ask of people is that if they have mistakes, they learn from them.
You are very angry about Gráinne Flannelly. I should remind people, she was the person that was the head of cervical check. And she had been interviewed a couple of times about disclosure to the patient. And would it be done by the clinician or would it be done by cervical check?
Yeah, I was very disturbed by the manner of her departure. Now, again, all the things that she was involved in were to be the subject of the Scally review, and it's fair to say that there was significant criticism in the review. What concerned me was the fact that she wasn't given the opportunity to answer for herself in that process.
And when the minister said on the 6 o'clock news that he didn't have confidence...
Yes, yeah, I actually believe that politicians and people like myself when I was Director General shouldn't rise to the media bait of expressing confidence or not. People are doing their job. Gráinne Flannelly had made a huge personal contribution to the establishment of cervical check, which, despite the controversies, has made a huge impact, a huge positive impact on women's health.
50,000 lives.
Well, certainly 50,000 high-grade detections, which means people who might have gone on to develop cancer didn't. That's a huge contribution.
Sure is.
And I think she deserved better treatment than she got. And You know, I was very clear at the time that I didn't think it was appropriate for her to find out that she didn't have the minister's confidence watching the television news.
Did you say that to him?
Of course, yeah. And we've discussed it.
And what did he say to you?
Well, I'm not really going to go into a private conversation because, you know, it wasn't intended for broadcast. But I'm sure that when he has reflected and said that there were things he wouldn't do the same way again, that that's probably one of them.
And giving a fresh test or a new test or an immediate test out to all women?
I think that's had consequences that he didn't foresee. And with the benefit of more rounded advice, perhaps, and again, with the benefit of hindsight, that's probably one of the decisions.
Did you advise him?
I wasn't aware that that decision was going to be made or announced, but I certainly have said before that I suggested that it should be walked back as quickly as possible because I foresaw consequences that were not the ones he intended to bring about.
I sometimes wonder if there is a structural impossibility between the HSE and the Department of Health. And I think it was you that was quoted, or maybe it was Mr. Scally, but I think it was you, that because of the structure, there's an animosity between the HSE and the Department of Health, with each one watching their back all the time and checking on each other's work.
Well, I wouldn't call it animosity. And I wrote an opinion column about this in the Sunday Business Post. I think that the aspects of what the HSE does are too intermingled and therefore creating confusion and problems with regard to the relationship with the Department of Health. And there's some duplication between activities, and so you have people on either side effectively marking each other. That absorbs a lot of time in managing those relationships. And I think it also creates some confusion as to responsibility and therefore accountability. In some other jurisdictions, not too far from here, some of the functions at the top of the HSE are actually transacted by the Department of Health in those jurisdictions. And the person who is fulfilling the role of Secretary General here in that department also is effectively chief executive of the NHS in Scotland, for example.
You think that's a better system?
I think
that's what you were brought in to do, to get rid of the HSE, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was appointed at a time when it was government policy to abolish the HSE, within 2 years, in fact. And halfway through my time, it became clear that it wasn't going to happen.
Why not?
I think essentially that the government, which was a coalition government, wasn't united and unified in that purpose. And therefore, it was not a viable policy. It wasn't going to happen, a bit like universal health insurance. These were Fine Gael policies. It wasn't entirely a Fine Gael government. It was, as you know, a coalition government.
Yeah.
And the Labour Party wasn't on for either of those things in reality.
Yeah, well, I don't want to go down this path now because I don't want to lose direction. But as I recall, there was talk of universal health, getting rid of private health insurance. And when the sums were done, the cost was just prohibitive. And so it was reversed.
Yeah, that it was, although that was a separate thing to the abolition
of
the
HSE.
You
think it should have gone ahead?
When we talk about the abolition of the HSE, we need to be clear. It's not abolishing the health service. Clearly, the vast majority of what the HSE does is delivered in community health organisations, in hospitals and so on, and that would continue. It's a question of those central planning, performance management, financing activities, which in other jurisdictions are done by a combined entity known as the Department of Health. A lot of those things used to be done by the Department of Health. They moved out when the HSE was created. I was never in favour of the creation of the HSE or in particular the way it was done. And I think that as part of this big reform of health, it is odd that the one thing that doesn't seem to be on the agenda is a review of how the Department of Health functions and whether this division, this duplication, is adding value or costing value. And I think on balance, it's costing value.
Let me go to the Children's Hospital. And you were, there were, alarm bells had started to ring and there were two further boards appointed and you were on one of them that was chaired by the Secretary General of the Department?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. The fact that alarm bells were there in that created those two extra boards might have led, one might have expected, to extreme vigilance because we've seen budgets go haywire in this country before on major projects.
Now, the reason those boards were created was because the original project back in 2013 was segregated from the HSE, which is a very effective, well-functioning estates department, which manages lots of big projects, mostly because the project was so long that it was expected the HSE wouldn't exist. When it was clear the HSE was continuing, there was always a risk that things would fall between the cracks, between the separate board, the hospital group itself, the department and the HSE. And for that reason, these two oversight groups were put in. And it was important that the Department of Health led on the governance structures. And myself as Director General and one of my Deputy Director Generals were part of that oversight group. And the alarm bells were ringing, but they were relatively quiet alarm bells because they related in total to a potential problem of €61 million made up of a number of things. One of which was additional fire prevention measures identified as general requirements in the aftermath of the Grenfell disaster. And there were one or two other things. And there was a big discussion. The focus at that point, given the scale, was on whether or not the fire prevention stuff merited a reference to government for additional funding, given that it was a new requirement. And then the discussion we were having with the board was whether the contingency should be availed of. At that point, we felt as a board that it was far too early to be looking at contingency, that things needed to be trimmed to remain within budget. At the time I left, that was the position. I left in May, and reading the papers and the documents that had been released, not too long afterwards, the alarm bells began to get much louder.
Well, within a month, the two very senior HSE people and two very senior Department of Health people knocked on the door and said, we've got serious problems here. Are you telling me you had no idea of that?
Absolutely. The last meeting of that board that I attended was in April, and the documents that have been released show that it wasn't the two HSE and department people who were knocking on the door. It was the development board that was knocking on their door, according to my reading of the documents.
Right, okay.
And at the June meeting...
But there was...
At the June meeting, as the second phase of the tendering process progressed, that's when they identified these much bigger risks, which we now all know about.
And if you didn't know, how come you didn't know? Like, it's a big responsibility. Like, I would put it to you that you all should have known.
Well, I would have needed a crystal ball to know in April what was going to happen in June. And as good as I am, a crystal ball I don't have.
Right. You left in May, was it?
I left on May the 11th.
Yeah. And this was in June?
Yes.
And this came like a bolt from the blue?
Well, it didn't come as a bolt like out of the blue to me in June, because I didn't know about it in June. But it wasn't known to the Oversight Board in April, which was the prior meeting, the
and
one
do
I was
people
at.
Never talk or pick up the phone to one another and say, you know, are we sure this is on track? I'm concerned about A, B or C. Or are people so afraid to have meetings and minutes and and things because they're afraid of FOIs? But, I mean, this is a very big task.
In my experience, to be fair to the individuals involved in the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board, as issues arose, they were open about them. So my working presumption, and obviously the PwC report will look at this, but this was brought to the Oversight Board in June because that's when it became a live issue. And until I hear otherwise, that's what I think we should work on the assumption of. If it had been a big issue in April, I'm confident that they would have brought it to the board in April.
There's something, I suppose, I don't want to sound like the PAC now, but there's something eternally frustrating about people like your good self and indeed ministers and indeed civil service rolling out kind of fudge for us when if anybody were building their own house, they'd be keeping an eye on the budget, they'd be keeping an eye on the money because they wouldn't be able to afford it. But there's a kind of a feeling that there's a presumption, it's government money. I heard one spokesperson saying, "Oh, Pascal Donoghue has deep pockets." They're our pockets.
Well, I don't think Pascal Donoghue feels he has deep pockets. To be fair to the man,
no, I didn't say that. I said another commentator.
I know Oliver Callan has a particular phrase. You know, I've only so much money. I've actually heard Minister Donoghue say that.
Yep.
He's very keen to keep a tight eye on public expenditure. I don't think your characterization is correct. The Development Board had some extraordinarily talented people on it.
Yeah.
It was remarkable for the fact that it was a ministerially appointed board and there was no cronyism at all about the appointments to it. It was a very solid board. And they were keeping a tight eye. That's why they had told us about the 61 million. But clearly, until they had progressed to a certain stage, they must not have known about the additional costs that were coming down the track.
Yeah, mind you, there was, seems to me to have been a complete flaw in something going ahead and contracts being signed without proper completion of design and proper completion of costing.
Well, they were following a particular type of procurement
process.
Yes,
I know.
And there is a general issue, I think. One of the things that is part of this debate is whether it's right to accept the lowest priced tender, even against background noise about the nature of the contractor and so on. And while I don't want to go into any issues about any particular contractor, in general, I think we've got to a cultural place where the public sector is driven always to accept the lowest price tender. Now, in the private sector, where you're not subject to judicial review, which can cost you enormous amounts of time and therefore money, all sorts of background intelligence would be taken into account, and the private sector might make a different decision. So a lot of the stuff I hear about this wouldn't happen in the private sector, well, it's true, but it's not because of any of the quality of the people in the public sector. It's because of the freedoms that they have.
Well, somebody to make a decision and take responsibility.
The word
accountability is thrown around now like snuff at a wake. Mm. What does accountability mean? Resign?
Well, accountability has a dictionary definition.
Yeah.
And it means taking responsibility for the things that you do. It doesn't mean resign. It doesn't mean being beaten up in the media. It does mean taking responsibility for the things you do. So when PwC go back, at every stage, the people in charge of this project will have had to make binary choices. Do you do A? Do you do B? One of those will have been about how to assess the tender. And as I say, I think part of the learning from all of this may be that the public sector needs to be given more freedom not to go for the lowest price tender.
Systems failure.
Well, I don't want to go to there, but it is a discussion we should have.
Okay.
Because I know that you yourself are quite frustrated by the term systems failure. But we shouldn't be afraid ever to identify a systems failure if that's what it is. Otherwise, we'll never fix
but
the
why
system.
Why does it only arise when things go wrong? I mean, you're the expert in management, masters in management. Systems failure is correct, and it should be looked at and it should be changed, but it should be changed before the disaster happens.
Well, I think that you obviously have to learn from things that go wrong and apply those lessons to the future.
Yeah, but wouldn't you like to anticipate them going
wrong
and get it right?
Of course you would.
I want to go to some of our listeners, and I'll be back to you. So this is an excuse to attack Sinn Féin rather than addressing the debacle of the overrun, says one caller. I can't believe the breathtaking arrogance of Tony O'Brien. I'm not a fan of any of the political parties, but this guy presided over the descent of our health service into absolute chaos. I'll come back to that. Tony O'Brien oversaw regular health overspends and showed arrogance when held to account by the Public Accounts Committee. Marion, another caller, says, without the PAC, we'd know nothing. Another caller says, Marion, listening to your discussion, if public servants in all levels of grades did their work honestly and efficiently, there would not be a need for the Public Accounts Inquiry. Another one says, totally agree with Mr. O'Brien about his views on the PAC and on the difficulty of being in a major public servant nowadays. Good people being hounded from office, and that comes from Cork. Another one says, hi, Marion. That man is venting his anger because very, very necessary committees like the PAC ask him some awkward questions that the public need answers. And much more besides. Can I come at this another way? And we'll get on to the nurses then. You were head of the HSE for 6 years?
Nearly.
Longer than a minister would get, or a politician would get, because we have our elections every 5 years. And in that time, the costs went up by 20%. And the waiting, like 20% is an awful lot of money. And at the same time, waiting times went up. There were some extra nurses employed, but with all of that money, What have you got to show for your 6 years?
I came into the job shortly after the HSE was downsized by 5% on one single day in 2012. Downsized, I mean 5% of the workforce were exited by reason of incentivised programmes, at a time when demand for healthcare was increasing very rapidly. What is remarkable, and it's not my achievement, but the achievement of about 140,000 people who work in the health service, of whom we should be justly proud, was that the health service actually didn't fall over as a result of that.
Why does the public... I mean, the word chaos was used there, and it is used quite a lot. People are afraid to go into A&E. People are afraid of our hospitals. I mean, that's supposed to be comfort. That's supposed to be reassurance for people.
If you actually look at the experience as measured by HICWA's National Patient Experience Survey of people who do go into hospitals, while there are clearly challenges and access to hospitals is chief amongst them, those who experience the health system say quite different things about it. And while
not
clearly,
unanimously, no, but it's true.
Not unanimously, yeah. What's ever unanimous anyway, to be fair. But the overwhelming response is much more positive. So we are seeing a narrative, and it does play into things like the nurses' strike, of a continuous narrative that demoralises, I think, the staff who work tremendously hard. The same staff that trudged through the snow through Storm Emma.
Right.
And did all those heroic things and go to work every day.
So do a lot of people go to work every day.
Yeah. How many people went to work during Storm Emma?
A lot of people.
Yeah, most of them in the health service. So I think we need to
I'm thinking of the ESB. Let's not set one group up.
I didn't mention the ESB.
I did.
I know you did. Yeah. So I'm not setting any groups up against each other. I am speaking with a degree of pride about the people who I used to lead in the health service, who I think do tremendous work. There is, however, a policy problem. We have a health system that is the wrong shape. Now, we do now have a new policy direction under Sláintecare, something I worked hard to try and create. What we haven't yet seen is momentum towards implementing it. And we have a history in this country, unfortunately, of punishing politicians who try to do really forward-thinking things with healthcare.
For example, there's
a politician who supported the reshaping of the hospital in Roscommon, which is now a very successful healthcare facility. He lost his job. The one who opposed it ended up, despite recent difficulties, with a cabinet position he might not otherwise have had. So as a people, we're not particularly good at rewarding politicians.
You wanted to close Portlaoise, the emergency department?
Not close it, no. But
make
some changes to it. And in particular, there are issues about the viability of its intensive care services and so on. What we wanted to do was improve it. And in due course, I'm confident that that hospital will be improved. And that
were you not going to reduce the hours?
Yes, in order to improve overall quality of care.
Yeah, but I mean, it's reduced the hours that the local people will hear.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. And it's important that the health service has a voice to make clear the benefits that will flow from that. But there is obviously a requirement for politicians not to feel that they will be punished for making decisions.
Same in Navan?
Navan is a hospital that has very few presentations between after the hour of midnight and so on. And it isn't either the best use of resources or likely to produce the best health outcomes to continue with that. But what we have now is a forward-looking policy which will reshape our healthcare system from an acute sector, a hospital-focused system, to one that brings care nearer to patients' homes.
But if you look at the investment and you go through, there's been a reduction in, and we had the GPs out this week. I mean, people are talking about the GP services and all of that as the panacea. But a lot of people experience going to a GP and being sent to A&E and referred for this and referred for that and referred something. But are you saying to me, so that's okay then?
No, I'm not. We have a significant problem ahead of us in general practice. In the teeth of the financial emergency, significant cuts were imposed on the resources in general practice. They would argue disproportionately unfair. Leaving that to one side, they're one of the very few sectors that haven't had a restoration of those cuts, as most public servants have.
Yeah.
It's become very unattractive in GP.
So you'd restore that now?
What we need to do is reach a proper settlement with general practice that they can sign up to, so that people, instead of wanting to leave the country to do general practice elsewhere. And one doctor I spoke to recently told me that he graduated from a class of 15 and 14 of his peers have gone elsewhere.
Right. You look at that.
Well, we have an age profile.
Can I just pause you there?
Yeah.
You look at that. You were in charge for 6 years and you presided over the regrettable decision by so many of our young, newly qualified people to leave. This was your watch.
With due respect, I didn't preside over that at all. The government decides on pay policy. The government decided to cut the pay for new entrant consultants.
Yeah, conditions?
The primary condition that's affecting general practice is the withdrawal of resources.
Right, but if you go right across the board within the frontline staff, they talk about conditions. Let me move on to the nurses. Would you give the nurses what they want?
I don't know if I'd be in a position to give them everything that they want, but the primary thing they're looking for right now is meaningful engagement on the issues that they want to talk about. And
money?
Money is one of the things that needs to be discussed, absolutely.
Would you give them the money?
I'm not going to attempt to preempt.
Oh, come on.
No,
would you?
What I am saying is I certainly wouldn't have invited them to talks about everything except money, as was done earlier in the week. The reason they ultimately are on strike right now is because they couldn't get a meaningful engagement about the issues that they identify as primary barriers to recruitment and retention. They see pay as part of that. So clearly, disputes are settled through discussion. They're settled in the grey, not in black and white. And it's important that they're given an opportunity to have real and meaningful talks. And I hope they are going to get that opportunity, and that as a result of that, it will be possible to at least pause the industrial action while the real issues are being talked about.
They're talking about, in the context of numbers and money and all that, that this could end up 70 to 80% of the entire health budget will go just on salaries.
Well, a very large proportion, not too far short of that, already does go on salaries. And there's a reason for that. You know, the health service is a people business. Most of the care that we all experience...
Is it a management business?
There is management involved, but primarily it's a people business. So all of us receive our care from people.
You talked about anecdotes. Anecdotally, if you talk to nurses and doctors, they will bewail the level of management that they regard as impeding them in doing their jobs.
I think the vast majority of people who have the title manager in the health service are probably actually nursing managers, but leaving that to one side, in general...
Why do you say that as if it's important? Does that take the nurse off of nursing duties and have her, as was described on the programme on one occasion, going around with a clipboard?
I don't think too many nurses go around with clipboards in that way. But it's important that nursing has a career structure. That's one of the things that's of importance. It's important that we make full use of the skills that nurses have. And it's obviously important that, you know, given that there are something like 37,500 nurses, that they're managed by nurses. That seems to make general sense. But I think you're referring to a broader narrative about the number of people in the total health workforce who are in administrative roles.
Yes.
And I know I've heard you say it. What it's important for listeners to be aware of is that the HSE has a tremendous range of purely administrative functions that it has to perform. If you want to get married someplace that isn't a designated marital place, some HSE official has to come and approve that. You want to register a birth, a death or a marriage, it's likely to be a HSE official involved. There are over 100,000 financial transactions just related to prescriptions. Those have to be done by administrators. There are a huge array of things that the organisation does that you wouldn't want to be using the time of nurses and doctors and other allied health professionals to do. So in that context, it's reasonable that a good chunk of the health service...
What chunk? What kind of a chunk?
I don't have the percentages in front of me. If I was still in the HSE, I'd have all those figures to give to you. But there are a whole array of things which are purely administrative functions that you'd want done by administrators. Also, at a time when we're having difficulty recruiting consultants, One of the strategies has been to lift the administrative burden off them by employing the types of people we can employ, some of which are administrators, secretaries and so on, to help them with their work. And that's certainly something that they would want you to do.
You controversially, since you mentioned consultants, said the idea, now I don't want to misquote you, of limiting the amount of private work that consultants can do is a farce?
What I said was the present rule, which says that those consultants who are allowed to treat privately insured patients in public hospitals shouldn't exceed 20%, is a farce in the following context. For the last few years, hospitals, by virtue of government policy, have been incentivized to convert privately insured patients into private patients at the front door of the hospital. About half the people in the country are privately insured. In that context, and given that most patients who are admitted to hospital these days are admitted through the emergency departments, what's the point of beating up the consultants if their ratios are out of whack? So I'm saying that that rule is a bit of a farce in the context where government policy is actually to try to convert those who are privately insured into private patients. Who's going to treat them?
To what point? For money?
Yeah, for money.
The government is looking for the money.
A policy decision a few years ago.
Oh, that's when James Riley, wasn't it? He changed it that if you go in, you were asked straight away,
exactly.
Did you have?
It's quite controversial. Obviously, the health insurers are concerned about it.
They are.
But in that context, if that's the policy direction, there's no point kicking the consultants if by virtue of government decisions and administrative procedures, we end up with them treating more than 20% of their total patients being privately insured, because it's not necessarily their fault. So in that context, I describe the policy as farcical.
Okay. And the perception, though, that it's very unfair. Now, I accept that 50% of the country has private insurance. But the perception is that if you have the insurance and if you've paid out the money, you can jump the queue. And that's, people find that deeply unfair.
It is. Now, I'm by virtue of the accent I have, despite living here for a long time, you know, I'm a child of the NHS.
Yeah.
I believe fundamentally in access based on need, not by financial means. And that's one of the reasons I support the fundamental objectives of Sláintecare Care.
Right.
But we have a long way to go to get there. Our system is kind of upside down. For years and years, we've prioritised hospitals and not primary care. The cuts I talked about, which you suggested I presided over, far from, they were government cuts, and I've argued for their progressive reversal for years. And I'm concerned that the most important medical relationship any of us has, which is our family doctor, our general practitioner, is not necessarily going to be a relationship that people will have in the future. The age profile of general practice means there's going to be a huge amount of retirement in the future. I'm worried that without intervention, we could be looking at the last generation of family doctors. And if we lose family doctors, we will lose the game.
Okay. I'm going to have to pause you there, if I may, because we have to take a break. I'm talking to Tony O'Brien, former Director General of the HSE, and we will be back with you after this.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, speaking of headlines and airtime, Tony O'Brien seems to have all the answers now. But reality is the health service went from bad to worse under his watch. The fact that he took a job in the US speaks volumes for how much interest he had in the Irish health service. That's a very important one. Tell us about that job.
Okay, well, first of all, I had decided in the summer of 17, I should say, that I wouldn't be continuing beyond the end of my term as Director General of the HSE. For all sorts of reasons. And as part of my planning my exit into a different career that I have now, one of those was to take on a non-executive directorship of an emerging company in the United States, which currently...
Pharmaceutical.
Yep. Biopharma.
And currently, the man involved is involved in the Eastern Group or the Western Group?
Can we come back to that after I tell you about the company? Because it doesn't currently have any products, isn't currently marketing anything. And as a non-executive director, I don't work there. And I was basically familiarising myself with the company as it was starting up. I wanted to be there from the beginning. I used to be chief executive of the Irish Family Planning Association. It's developing some innovative non-hormonal contraceptives. I wanted to be part of that. There was no conflict of interest with anything I was doing, and it took up minimal amounts of time.
Now, can I come back to the man? Was he the Eastern Group or the Western Group of hospitals?
It's called... Ireland East, yeah.
Ireland East. And his role within it?
He is a non-paid volunteer chair of a board of an organisation that doesn't yet exist.
Right.
In the sense that it's not had legislation. It's not created.
And are there share options?
In which?
Is there a promise of share options within the company?
Within the company that I'm on the door? Yes, yeah. Of course. The American corporate culture is very much based upon a different view of how you reward participation.
Right.
So in due course, share options will vest. And if the company is successful, I'll benefit from that. And if it's not, I won't.
But you already get paid anyway by them.
Yes, I get paid fees for being a non-executive director.
Right. Now, you said...
I had the consent. My contract provided that I could seek consent from the minister for that, provided there was no conflict of interest. I sought that consent. He knew I was going to leave. He knew I was planning for my future. And as things turned out, I ended up leaving 10 weeks before I intended to. And given all the fury and the controversy, I was actually personally quite pleased that I'd begun the steps to build my successor career. And I don't regret that. And I reject the notion that there was any conflict of interest.
Well, it's within the medical world. It's within the pharmaceutical world. These things can be controversial within the world of health, the Department of Health, the experience of health here. You had a big job to do in your role as Director General. And you may say it didn't take you much time, but these things take head time. Mm. And people would say, well, my goodness, you know, we've complaints about this in the health service, we've complaints about that in the health service, and here's the Director General engaging as a board member in an emerging company.
Yeah, just to be clear, the company doesn't have any products, so there's no conflict of interest from that point of view.
Well, it's aiming to.
Yeah, but not until
it's
next...
It's aiming to.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
Well,
there'd be no point in having the company if it didn't have the aim. But there was nothing, no potential immediate conflict. As to the time, it was costing me less than 1 hour a week. And in my spare time, I also respond to emergency calls. And I spent far more time doing that in my private time than I did on this company. And in addition, as anyone who knows me would tell you, I did not spare the time for the job either.
Right. And you don't think that you were really infuriating people by doing that when there are so many problems? They don't know what you do in your private time. They don't know that you take HSE calls in your private time. They wanted you to sort out the HSE.
Absolutely. And there was nothing involved in that that got in the way of me doing my job then or at any stage prior to. And as I say, I had gone through all the procedures set out in my own contract. Nothing private, nothing secret, all above board, all documented. People are entitled not to like it. That's their choice.
Okay, Tony O'Brien just doesn't get it. There's no rush to judgment on the Children's Hospital. The judgment is now too late. Contracts are signed and the taxpayer is taking the burden. How refreshing to hear a man speak honestly and have the courage to say how it is. If those politicians on PAC take note, they might stop their antics and lust for publicity and achieve something. Another one. Hi, Marion. Totally agree with Mr. O'Brien. We're too quick to force a resignation in this country, to do so often without the facts. Well, of course, the other side of that is very often people don't resign and, you know, fudge the whole issue and say nothing to see here or my old friend systems failure. Anyway, did Tony O'Brien not see any conflict of interest? That's the question we were just discussing. Going on the board of a private healthcare company while still AHG's CEO, your answer to that is no?
Absolutely, there was no conflict of interest.
Okay, milkmen and delivery men went out in all weathers for very little remuneration and no big pensions. My daughter and all her class qualifying as children's nurses are leaving immediately or only staying long enough to save the fare for Melbourne. Who will staff the new hospital? My sister works for the HSE in Dunleary. There's managers managing managers to cover themselves. No one is accountable. Now, that is a perception that I know you say Having worked in the HSE, I watched managers being appointed with no experience, no remit of their duties, low-grade, hard workers in the service taking the anger of the public. That's the flip side.
Can I just say something about those managers?
Yeah.
Because when the exit strategy in February 2012 occurred, it was deliberately targeted to exit the higher-paid people who were, by definition, longer-serving managers. So a lot of senior people who'd been developed to be managers left. The 95% who were left, many of those, without wishing to, had no option but to take on those higher duties. They hadn't had the benefit of investment in training. Training budgets had been cut. So to some extent, I sympathise with what the caller is saying, but it's not the fault of the individuals who stayed behind, who worked for less pay, worked harder, took on higher levels of responsibility.
Right.
Wasn't their choice.
You talk about accountability. Did you ever fire anybody?
Yes, I did. Many.
Really?
There is a perception that no one gets fired in the health service. It's not true. Obviously, one doesn't issue a press release when you fire somebody.
That's how not many would you say?
Personally, in the time that I was in the health service, because I was at a very senior level, I would only be firing very senior people. But I would probably put it at about 5 or 6. But I would be aware of many other dismissals, because one of the functions that I performed was to hear what are called ad misericordiam appeals. Mercy appeals. And I would have dealt with several dozen of those in my time, which means all those people would have been dismissed somewhere else in the system.
Well, for what kinds of things?
All the usual unfortunate stuff that you'd imagine. Misappropriation of patients' property, being drunk on duty, failure to act.
What do you mean, failure to act?
Failure to carry out functions which were necessary for the benefit of the organisation or for the people it serves. The usual things that people get fired for in any walk of life. While I'm terribly proud of the 140,000 people who worked then and work now, clearly within any group of that size, there are going to be some who are going to be hired incorrectly, in the wrong jobs, etc. And it's important that any organisation deals with that. That's not to say that I'm saying that the organisation is perfect at dealing with such things. I'm not.
Okay. Marion, I think Tony O'Brien did an admirable job in the HSE against all the odds. It's a dysfunctional organisation set up for political ends, and he was paid a fraction of what he could earn in private industry. That job is a poisoned chalice. Good luck filling it. Your comments on that?
I did the job for 300 weeks. I intended to do it for 310. I think 302 weeks, maybe. The 300 weeks, despite the challenges, I enjoy doing the job because there are tremendous people. And despite the things that we didn't get done, I was able every week to see some area of improvement. Now, you don't see the improvement. You see the things that we haven't improved. Now, the last 2 weeks were pretty bad, and I would have preferred to see out the remaining 10. I felt that the competition to recruit my successor was too soon. I think it was, you know, the Scali report hadn't come through, the atmosphere was very toxic, so I wasn't surprised the first competition didn't succeed. There's a competition underway now. It's a really important job, a real opportunity to make
You're
a contribution.
You're glad to be out?
Well, I was intending to leave anyway.
Are you glad to be out?
I am. Right. To be honest, I spoke at a conference the other day, and when I arrived, on the badge it said Health Service Executive, and I thought, God, I'm glad when I woke up this morning I wasn't Director General. It was Thursday, the day of the nurses' strike. There were all sorts of things going on. So I'm happier to be out than I would be to still be there.
And can I go back to a point I made earlier on? Because the politicians take a lot of flack, and we've had so many ministers for health, and you have to presume they were all full of good intentions. The question is, how can they get around vested interests, local politics, and all of those things? And they take a lot of flack. Do you feel that your contribution transformed the health services in Ireland? Because you've got a longer run at it than they do.
I don't think it transformed it. And the reason it didn't transform it is because for half of it, I was pursuing one set of government policies and then I was doing the opposite. So that isn't a transformative process. I did go way out on a limb before the last election to say we needed a really grown-up debate about health. We needed a cross-party consensus that could transcend the electoral cycle, much as you spoke of earlier. And if that is followed through on, then I like to think that the contribution I made, particularly arguing for a transformation fund so that we could begin to develop primary care rather than trying to do it without new investment,
okay,
that may well be a legacy. And if it is, I'll be very glad about it.
OK. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And a little later, as they say, then advertise, we'll take our break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.